You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is providing career pathway scholarships for current high school seniors and anyone else who has earned a high school diploma or GED to help fund an associate's degree or professional certification. Residents of seven counties in northern New Mexico may apply at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships, lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. The deadline is May 31st. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe John L. Smith. He's an award-winning journalist. He's the author of many books. His latest book is called The West Side Slugger, Joe Neal's Lifelong Fight for Social Justice. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. It's a wonderful book about an African-American politician who grew up in Louisiana, ended up in Nevada. Who is he? How did you decide to write a book about it?
You know, thanks for inviting me on the show, first of all. Joe Neal's story is really near to my heart. The first time I heard his name mentioned was over the dinner table as a young guy, 10 years old or so. My mother, who was in Democratic Party politics, she worked for the governor. And Joe Neal was a fired-up, first-term Democrat in the state Senate, first African-American in the Nevada state Senate, very much alone in many ways. We can talk about that. But he didn't always get along with the Democrats in the party. My father, who was in the organized labor movement in the building trades, he led the painters union at a time when unions were reluctantly and slowly integrating. They weren't all excited about it. Now we don't think of it, perhaps, but back then it was a very big deal to start to blend the races in the trades. And so his name was often mentioned, and not always politely. When I ran into him, when we decided to do the book, I said that, and he laughed, of course, because that's been his story, has always been standing up while others were content to sit down. You know, as years passed, I covered him as a journalist, and he was often on the short end of votes in the state Senate, but often the guy who was the progressive leader of the moment, of reminding people of the inequities of society and of Las Vegas's and Nevada's past with its tremendous real racial issues. And so when, after he left office, we decided just a few years ago, he would sit down and talk about the issues, and I'd poured through many hundreds and hundreds of clips and many of his speeches. Just one small collection of them was bound by his colleagues in the Senate and is read by state senators in Nevada. And so it just happened. And for me, you know, I always tell folks it's a labor of love. I was afraid that Neal, who had shown so much courage, was going to be forgotten as Nevada transitioned into its different phases.
Joe Neal grew up poor in Louisiana, sharecropper family. He literally owned one set of clothes. You tell this story about how he wanted to take a trip and he had to borrow a shirt. But he was very ambitious. He found his way out of that life by going into the military. And in the military, he found both an integrated workplace for the first time in his life. He was a young man, but also very ugly racism at the same time. Tell us about that.
Right. You know, once you were in the military, and he served in the Air Force, once you were on the base doing your job, things were so regimented that racism really wasn't overtly tolerated. It was perhaps in other ways was showed, but not for Joe. Joe was a guy who, coming from Madison Parish, which was considered what they called the blackest county in America, had the highest population of African Americans, none of whom voted. And that would, of course, play a role in his own political career going forward. But in the military, he got to see life outside of Louisiana. However, he ran into issues whenever that bus would stop and the members of the Air Force that he was with would get off the bus and have to go to the cafes, in Texas especially, and elsewhere. He would immediately run into that racial experience, you know, that old Jim Crow experience where he would have to sit separate. If he wanted to eat, he had to sit apart from his colleagues and fellow members of the Air Force. And that really burned at him. And there were several experiences that he went through there. It's one of the things that fired him going forward, that if he was good enough to serve his country, he ought to be good enough to enjoy the civil rights that were his by birth. You know, he wasn't asking for something that wasn't already granted by birth.
It's the experience that in so many ways gave rise to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, which is so many soldiers served in World War II and then came home and said, hang on, we just defeated Hitler and now we're supposed to be subservient again?
Absolutely. And I think once people went through that experience, especially in World War II, and now Neil didn't go to war, he was on Air Force bases. He was a part of a military police operation in New Mexico, in Texas for a bit, and then at Indian Springs in Nevada. But, you know, he experienced that. And for him, it was one of those sea change moments in a young person's life where you're doing the work. You know, you're doing the work and more, and yet you're expected to take the lesser job once you're out of the service, or perhaps have no real opportunity at all.
So he was intensely driven. He took every opportunity to get an education, whether it was college, correspondence courses, within the military. And then he ended up in Nevada. Why Nevada?
Well, his mother came out from Louisiana to Las Vegas in the 50s during what's considered the migration of folks from Fordyce and Tallulah. They came out for job opportunities.
Fordyce and Tallulah being?
Those are small towns in Arkansas and Louisiana with high populations of African Americans who were seeking employment, the kind of employment that opened during World War II with the factories in Henderson, Nevada, and then again after World War II as Las Vegas began to boom again and began to hire persons of color for things like housekeepers and that sort of thing. Always back of the house is what they call that in the casino business. So his mother came out in the early 1950s to get a job as a maid at one of the hotels.
1950s in Las Vegas was very segregated, and you describe it beautifully in the book. I mean, it's not a pretty scene for African American people. How was it different and not different from the Jim Crow South that they had come from?
Well, for Neil growing up in the Jim Crow South, the rules were essentially understood. They may not have been appreciated, they may even have been fought against, but they were understood. He came west naively believing that we'll go out to the desert, to this very different place, and find different rules applying. And the Las Vegas of the 1950s, you know, Nevada was often referred to as the Mississippi of the West. It was very backward, even for America in that era. And so he came out and found the job opportunities weren't there, that he really wasn't welcomed, that the West Side proper, that section of the community where the blacks lived, still had, you know, outhouses and was by no means enjoying the boom that the rest of Las Vegas was enjoying. And of course, in that era, you know, famously, Sammy Davis Jr. was a star on the strip with the Will Mastin Trio and had to sleep over on the West Side at night because he couldn't sleep in the hotel. And so many stories like that, Lena Horne and Ella Fitzgerald and so many of the celebrities who packed the showrooms were stuck, you know, in the Jim Crow era in Las Vegas, staying on the West Side, staying in a bungalow out back as long as you're out of sight and you don't walk through the casino. And so there are those kinds of experiences that really took place well into the late 50s and some would argue even into the early 60s.
There's a story in your book about how Lena Horne somehow manages to be able to stay in a bungalow on casino property.
Right.
And after she leaves, the workers were instructed to literally burn the sheets she'd slept in.
That's right. And that's the kind of treatment that the most celebrated members of the black community would get. The others were much worse off than that. You know, they weren't close to even, literally even walking through the casino was controversial. In downtown, there were people who were dragged out of casinos when they tried to cross into them. And so that's really the Las Vegas that Neil was introduced to. And as he became more fired up politically, it became a real sore spot with him. And he was one of those people who was willing to speak his mind about it.
Well, tell us about how he got into activism, and then, I mean, he eventually ran a couple of times, first unsuccessfully, then successfully for state senate. But what were the first issues that he started working on?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, the saving grace for so many poor boys and girls is military service. As we know, you know, the GI Bill has really helped to give people educational opportunities that they never would have received. And that was the case with Neil. After the Air Force, he gets the GI Bill and winds up going to Southern University. And at Southern, he studies politics and the law. And on campus, he's reminded by a mentor and a professor who says, you know, you're Joe Neal, you're from Madison Parish. Who are you going to vote for, Joe? And Joe says, well, I don't really know. And there's laughter, cynical laughter. And he says, well, of course you don't know. You can't vote. Because down there, no one had registered. No one had ever registered, was ever allowed to register. And in the case of that parish, you had to have, you know, Neal had to have someone vouch for him. Someone essentially from the white community to vouch for him to vote. And of course, no one ever had done that. And he eventually became part of the Justice Department's push to register voters throughout the South for the first time since Reconstruction. He was part of a small group of people there who he actually became the first registered voter in the history of that parish of color.
In Louisiana.
Yes. And he did not stay in Louisiana after being registered. He came back to Las Vegas, but came back with a kind of fire burning and immediately began to volunteer with political parties, began to participate in a process at a time when the black population in Southern Nevada was also growing and was one of those kind of untapped resources for political clout. You see it everywhere in New Mexico, all the small communities. Once they're activated, then their votes really do count. And the black community was being courted by certain politicians, including Republicans, because, of course, in previous generations, many blacks were Republican.
And so, because of the legacy of Lincoln,
right. And so you have that transition time in Las Vegas, which was quite tumultuous, and Neil wound up surfacing, realizing the reason why, in addition to not being essentially welcomed into the political process, the people of color also were fighting a gerrymandering issue. So he helped change the boundaries that enabled people of color to get elected. Then he got elected, and he was in office for more than three decades.
Well, that was one of the things that's so interesting. I mean, African Americans had the vote in Nevada. They didn't have to go through, you know, that whole series of things that people were going through in the South, whether it was poll taxes or literacy tests or, I mean, the way Joe Neal got to register in Louisiana was there was a test where they had to interpret details of the Louisiana Constitution. And he was so smart and so educated that he could.
Right.
But most people couldn't. Meanwhile, in Louisiana, you had the vote, but you didn't have representation. And so that was one of the things that he immediately saw and started fighting against.
Right, and he realized that change in any neighborhood, in any area of the community, was only going to occur if you had the ability to go and kind of speak truth to power at the legislature and make your issues heard. Even when they didn't want to hear them, he would often read into the record, whether it was historical notes or it was the needs of the community, he would read them into the record, and people didn't want to hear it, but because he had the floor, he could put it in the historical record. So for all time, when people came to look, they would see that these were the issues that were going on that were being unmet. It was quite wise.
Well, that was one of the things that was so brilliant about how he did things. One of the things was, when bills came up for consideration, he read them,
right,
which was apparently unusual. And he also memorized the particular parliamentary procedure manual for the state and mastered that so that he was able to, you know, take the floor when when issues came up and so on.
Mason's Manual, as it's known, is 800 pages of parliamentary procedure, kind of Robert's Rules writ large. And it's one of those things that everyone is told that the rules of the legislature are guided by this document, you know, this book. And then, of course, that book generally collects dust on the shelf of most state legislators. In Nevada, the legislature is considered a part-time sitting legislature. So they're only
New Mexico.
Right. So they're only there every other year. They're only there for a few months. And they're often there because they're representing a constituency of cab owners or casino interests or mining interests. And so Joe took advantage of the opportunity to read the manual. He read it and read it again and became really masterful at it. And this is in the many interviews I did of people who served with him and watched him work. They all said the same thing. They all said Joe Neal was the master of the rules at a time when, of course, often when he stood up, people didn't want to hear him speak at all because he was going to remind them of a sore spot in the general community.
The political influence, as you said, of certain special interests, and especially casinos, was, of course, huge. And people like Howard Hughes was very influential and overtly racist. Describe that to us, what that influence looked like, how Neal addressed it.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Hughes is, especially in the kind of general perception of him, you know, the aviator perception or the eccentric with the long fingernails and the crazy hair and all of that, there are these images of Hughes, none of which are really important. In a transitioning Las Vegas, at a time it was really coming into its own in terms of civil rights, Hughes was completely the wrong person to come in and take over the casino industry and have influence over it. His private letters show a guy who is just virulently racist. I mean, feared the germs of blacks and feared so many things. Not only would they be bad for business, but Arthur Ashe, you know, we canceled the tennis tournament because Arthur Ashe, a black man, would be in it. You know, that was the Hughes. But bringing that mentality at a time when he was acquiring so many properties, it really slowed the process down of the kind of maturing of a community that was really in need of maturing. And Neal, at the time, was fighting to integrate the labor movement, the trade unions. He was promoting programs of apprenticeship for minorities. He was helping to integrate the Nevada Test Site, which is an enormous employer. And so to see those two come to loggerheads, really, in their own ways, Hughes was, of course, a major, major player. But to see that happen, Hughes really dragged the town backward at a time when he was getting great credit for, you know, things like, you know, putting the mob out of Las Vegas, which is absurd. He didn't do that. But putting the mob out of Las Vegas and promising to build a medical school, which he didn't, fulfill, and so many other issues that he failed to do.
One of the things that kind of makes you see how far we've come since that time is that when Joe Neal started running, the question of whether a black person should put his face on the poster when he was campaigning, on his campaign posters, was a question. And he did, and early on he lost, and there was another woman who decided not to, and she won.
Right.
Because they didn't know that she was black.
Well, she used three names, Helen Lamb Crozier. And Lamb, of course, in southern Nevada, was a very, very popular name. The Sheriff Lamb was the sheriff. There was a county commissioner named Lamb, and one of the most powerful people in the state legislature was Floyd Lamb. And they were all one big family. And, of course, Helen Crozier was African-American and wasn't related to the Lambs, but that middle name alone helped her with votes. And, of course, Neal saw that. He was discouraged from putting his face on his placards and laughed about it and said, look, when they meet me, they're going to know I'm black. And so that's really where he came from. He was all about pushing the conversation forward.
It's really such an interesting portrait of a person who had a great deal of personal ambition, but his ambition wasn't for himself so much. It was really for a larger community.
Right. There are many examples of that. For instance, from the very first session of the legislature in 73, when he first served, until the very end, he pushed for convicted felons who had done their time, who qualified, for them having their civil rights returned. because he knew, as most folks who study the issue know, that people of color go to prison more. They spend more time in prison, and they have a harder time when they come out of prison without their civil rights restored. He knew that then. Now even the Koch brothers know that. You know, there are many conflicting interests are all on the same page on this issue now. He was talking about it in the 70s. And those kinds of issues were really kind of clarion calls for people to think, you know, in the mid-70s, throughout the mid to late 70s, the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment for Women, was a big topic of discussion throughout America. And in Nevada, backward Nevada, always dragging its feet when it comes to rights issues, Neal was a major proponent of ERA in the state Senate at a time when, you know, the vast majority, of course, of members of that body were male, and they weren't all that interested. And so, you know, he wound up, and the only time it ever passed in the state Senate was when Neal managed to pull the rule book out and read it and notify and call for a vote at the appropriate time, and they wound up squeaking by in that body. It wound up failing in the assembly that year. So those kinds of issues are those big ticket issues that kind of will, you know, drive society forward. Neal was all about that.
And where the Equal Rights Amendment was concerned, there was this great moment where he started speaking and he invoked the Pledge of Allegiance, and he said, you know, with liberty and justice for all, well, what do you call all if you don't want women to have equal rights? Yeah. It makes one love him. One thing that was also really interesting for me about reading this book was, I mean, he ran for office and for the first time won state Senate in 1972, started serving the following year. And at that time, politics in Nevada, in the whole country, were really constituted differently. There was a lot of division, but it wasn't the kind of partisan division, that kind of rigid partisan division we have now. What did it look like? Like, how did politics play out? It wasn't just like the Democrats versus the Republicans.
Well, there was certainly plenty of that. But in Nevada, it was really, in the state Senate, it was essentially a gentleman's club. There weren't a lot of raised voices. There were differences of opinion, but it was considered impolitic to command the floor and, you know, begin a real process of demonstrative discussion of issues.
So it was basically considered impolite to debate the issues you were voting on.
Well, yes, and in no small part because, you know, many, many of those issues were essentially decided ahead of time by the people who were writing the bills and handing them to the state senators who, as I said, served really as part-time legislators.
So lobbyists.
So lobbyists, of course. Yeah, the casino interests were big and getting bigger in those days, but also there were mining interests to consider, and there were other special interests throughout the state, as all states have. And it's no big surprise that legislators at pretty much every statehouse in America are getting bills that they don't actually write. But in Neal's case, he had an agenda that was different. He also was involved in a number of major issues that bore immense fruit for Nevada, made some real changes that aren't directly tied to civil rights, for instance. And that includes the hotel fire safety legislation that he helped craft in the wake of the deadly MGM Grand fire in 1980 that killed more than 80 people. It was Neal who helped drag the casino industry into the modern era. That legislation, once it passed, was used as a template in many other states across the country as really ideal legislation for retrofitting of high-rise buildings. And so there were other issues that he was quite involved in and quite successful at, but he would always be marginalized in the press, for the most part, as the fire brand, you know, from the West Side, the West Side slugger who was always out swinging at the issues.
Which is a way that people who are not majority or marginalized in one way or another are so often treated in the press.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Part of the problem with the growth of our country and the growth, in this case, of Nevada, part of the problem is that the mainstream press, they tend to fall in with the powerful. because that's where the quotes are, that's where the influence is, that's where a lot of the information comes from. And of course, that's a commodity. You know, the powerful understand that if you open the spigot, you'll find a friend in the press. But a lot of the folks who didn't enjoy that mainstream coverage had to fight against it, including, you know, at one point, one of the popular columnists in Las Vegas, when Neil stood up to the sheriff, who in that community was the most powerful politician in the community, was the sheriff of Clark County. He stood up to the sheriff when unarmed black men were being brutalized on the west side, were being shot, etc., and was considered to be intimidating the sheriff. Well, although Joe Neal was unarmed, of course, and was not, wasn't accompanied by squad cars full of SWAT members, and he wasn't the most powerful politician in the county, but he was somehow intimidating the sheriff. So it was, you know, it would be funny, I guess, if it weren't so sad and true.
How did the makeup of the state assembly, the Senate, and other political and government positions change over the years of Neal's service in terms of more racial minorities, women entering positions of power?
Now, this is one of the interesting parts of the Nevada story, is that the state that was, by pretty much everyone's measure, was pretty backward when it came to civil rights, was backward when it came to treatment of women, certainly exploiting women has always been the casino industry's, you know, one of its main things, you know, becomes this place through changing demographics, through rapid growth, through changing demographics, you have a state that starts electing people of color, that starts electing women. And now we transition to modern Nevada, which has the first female majority legislature in the history of the United States. And it's an amazing thing. And there are a handful of people responsible for that, for standing and for demanding their rights, demanding to be heard, and Neal is among those. Heading the legislature in Nevada, you have persons of color, you have leaders in many, many committees for the very first time being from the minority set, which of course, you know, is in itself transitioning.
And the police and sheriff's departments?
Yes, and the police departments are far more aware, as many, many departments are, but it's a far more aware organization now, with a lot of growing pains, to be sure.
Have they been hiring more?
There's no question this. In the last 20 years, Southern Nevada's police department has gone through tremendous transition and growing pains. There are several communities within that Southern Nevada area. Las Vegas is the best known, but there's North Las Vegas, Henderson, Boulder City. You have others, and you have leadership now of color. You have leadership, women as leaders in that department. So those are the kinds of things that really are telling, especially when you remember the not so good old days.
And one of the people in this historical first majority female state government is one of Joseph Neal's daughters.
Yes, Dina Neal is an assemblywoman now and serving her third or fourth term in the assembly and contributing to the state in a kind of next generation. And it's one of those things. Neal goes up to the legislature now as that emeritus guy that comes into the legislature, and there's a portrait of him on the wall of the building, which when you see where he came from, it's really a phenomenal thing. One of the things that makes America something wonderful to think about, despite all the other things that aren't so good.
To what extent did black state legislators like Neal from different states communicate and work with one another during the time that Neal was in office?
That was a slow process to begin with, but Neal participated in regional, you know, minority political groups, especially with California, but all the way back to the East Coast, to Washington, D.C. There was a kind of a networking that took place, and he actually developed, because of some stances he took on apartheid, he actually developed a kind of international network as well, like all the way to South Africa with some connections there. And so that's where he found success, but he did so at a, you know, paying a price to do it. He became alienated from a lot of the powerful politicians in the southern part of the state.
There's also some nice kind of personal information about Neal in the book, like the way he raised his children. when they wanted toys, he made them get books. You know, when they wanted to watch the Flintstones, he made them read the encyclopedia.
Right.
But that belief in education was something he brought forward not only in his family, but in his political life.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Not only from the Neal family standpoint, where you hit it right on the head. Joe and his wife Estelle, who was the first black dietitian in Nevada, they really preached that to their kids. And my interviews with them were, you know, there was just, the bells were ringing about it, because all those years later, once you've gone through that and you're disciplined, you know, then the college degrees are more attainable, and the whole Neal family is successful in its own right. But Neal focused, you know, remembering a time growing up in Mounds, Louisiana, where the only reading material that he had were newspapers that he would collect, old newspapers, and some tattered textbooks at Thomastown School, and a few other items, including, of course, the family Bible, because he wasn't allowed in the library. And so he kept that material, including some copies of newspapers from black-owned newspapers from out of state, and things like Jet Magazine, you know, which became read to tatters. And so he remembered that. He remembered being shunned at the library. And so when it came time to help create the legislation that allowed Nevada for the first time in a generation to expand its library system, Neal did that with a man named Charles Huntsberger. And they wound up expanding, greatly expanding the libraries in southern Nevada, where most of the population is in the state, but also, you know, opening new library branches in places like Elko in far northern Nevada, cattle country and mining country. So that's really another mark that he left on the state.
Talk about your relationship with Joe Neal, what it was like writing basically a biography about somebody who's still very much with us.
Right, yeah. It was an interesting process, you know. I've called it a labor of love, and it really was. You know, I have great respect for him. And also, I knew that taking this on would be some criticism, because Neal was often criticized for not getting more legislature through the process, that he wasn't willing to grind the sausage. He was too much of an iconoclast. And there's some truth in that. You know, he may have been able to have a better batting average if that's your goal, but that wasn't his goal. His goal was to, for instance, to remind the state that Nevada's casino industry, most powerful industry in the state, pays the lowest casino tax in America, and likes it that way. And so that was Joe Neal. Joe Neal would stand up and bring up those sore subjects. But for me, we met on a regular basis. We met at a couple of donut shops, which wasn't good for my health. But we had a great conversations. I did a lot of recording there. There were also oral histories that he had given, and of course a lot of background research. He's been written up in a number of books on specific topics, like, for instance, water quality at Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, he was an advocate for keeping Lake Tahoe environmentally clean.
Yes, he was a key committee member in Nevada at a time when the casino industry at Tahoe wanted to continue to expand its footprint, but by expanding that, it tended to endanger the water quality. There were issues of sewage problems and clarity and purity and all of that. And Neal wound up siding with California legislators who were more essentially more ecologically aware. And he wound up siding with members, it was a two-state committee that handled it. He sided with the opposition, if you will, and was vilified for it. They tried to kick him off the committee, and instead, of course, just raised his voice, and they had to go back into the shadows. And they wound up getting better quality of legislation through the process and signed by then-Governor Michael Callahan.
So Joe Neal left a real impact on the state of Nevada and is remembered, and your book is playing a role in his being remembered. What do you see as the most major pieces of his legacy?
Well, I think it's a bit complex. I think that you have to first start with a person who is essentially a soldier in a civil rights battle. Not a general, but a soldier coming from Madison Parish, coming literally from picking cotton and working on a piece of a sharecropped farm as a boy. Coming from that era of America and going through those transitions and fighting through them, not accepting the status quo.
To the point where he said he was willing to die for civil rights.
There's no question about it. And for many years was often followed home by the police. You know, he was in an attempt to intimidate him whenever he was speaking out on the issues that affected them. So you have that person. And I thought he was a great illustration of that struggle, especially as it pertains to Nevada. But more than that, more than being the voice that brings out the painful truth, I think Joe Neal helped Nevada move into the heart of the 20th century when it came to racial relations. I think he reminded a lot of people in high places who didn't necessarily want to hear it, that there were many voices, many concerns, many needs in the community that were not being met. He not only did that in a rally, he did that day after month after year. And that steady drumbeat really helped the state to mature at a time when it really needed to. You don't always get thanked for that. But for me, that's the key legacy. If you go by major accomplishments, I go from the Martin Luther King holiday, pushed it through for Nevada. Now we all take it for granted, and everyone seems to love it. But folks will forget that, you know, Arizona nearly burned its own capital when that was suggested. And Nevada dragged its feet on the issue, and so many states did, that you see those transitions, that giving respect to Dr. King, giving respect to African American History Month, and things like that. Now, those are things that some would say, well, black politician, these are those issues. In reality, those are big issues. And to separate the state's pension investment fund from corporations and that embraced apartheid, those are big steps. They're not really small. Add to that a new library system. Add to that his name is on the state mental hospital because of his push to try to help the mentally ill in the community who tend to gravitate toward the poor end of the spectrum. You've got a public education champion, a guy who ran for governor twice, not to essentially win the job, but to remind people that the haves in the state, and they're defined most by the casino industry, but that industry makes so much in Nevada and doesn't do enough. It doesn't pull its own weight. And no one would dare say that, because as a casino executive once said to Neil, you know, Joe, if money would beat you in a race, you'd be out of office, because money's no object. Right. But what he had was the loyalty of his constituents. And so it was despite those kinds of odds that Neil really prevailed. When you add things like the water quality at Lake Tahoe, you add the retrofit bill, and so many others, that you have this amazing kind of picture, I think. And Neil did it, and he started from such humble means. I think that to me is what it just, to this day, gives me pause.
You say you don't always get thanked for that kind of work. This book is in itself a big thank you for that work. Before we go, I wanted to ask you, what are you working on now? I mean, you're dividing your time between New Mexico and Nevada.
Yeah, you know, I just love New Mexico. New Mexico is so rich with culture, with people. And I'm freelancing here. My wife Sally Denton and I are doing a study of the history of gambling in New Mexico, and we're working on a lot of different projects together. You know, freelance writing projects. We're both freelancers. And so I'm just having a great time. I am wearing out my Subaru between Santa Fe and Southern Nevada. I live in Southern Nevada. I live in Boulder City now, which is a small town outside of the main Las Vegas area. And so, but I'm having a great time. It's kind of a new chapter in my life. I got married a year ago.
To the wonderful writer, historian Sally Denton, who we've had on this show over the years many times.
Yeah, you know, and we are just having, I think we're having the time of our lives. I certainly am.
John Smith is author of the book, The West Side Slugger, Joe Neal's Lifelong Fight for Social Justice. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.